It's all there. All the ingredients are there. The earth, water, fire, air, ether, and all the various things, they're all there. But they're not manifest in their own positions yet. They're just mixed up. That's why we gave the example of the cosmic soup. But when they're activated by the glance of the Lord, then they start separating. So then, you know, the earth, well, first of all, the false ego comes out, and you get, you could say something like a whole lump of false ego. I mean, I'm being a little figurative about it. Suddenly you get all the false ego. And then you get the three modes. And then you get, well, there's a whole procedure. The false ego, then the three modes interact with the false ego. Mind is produced of the interaction of false ego with sattva-gun. Then the senses are produced of the interaction of false ego and raja-gun. So in this way, all the different things, which all the different parts of the material creation become manifest in a raw form. Then later, the universes, a little later, the universes are injected in also. And then all these ingredients are like divided up and put into the universes. And then the universes expand. This we'll be reading about shortly. But the basic point, you know, the thing is, in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verse 14, Krishna says, Daivi Yesha Gunamai, that this divine energy of mine consisting of the three modes. And if I remember correctly, Srila Prabhupada addresses this point in the purport there. He says that the material energy is divine because it's one of Krishna's energies. Yeah. So in an ultimate sense, it's certainly divine. But still it's the material energy. Still it's the material energy. You know, that divine energy, it's a transformation of the original, that spiritual energy. So when living entities become devotees, and then they, you know, they use things like this microphone in Krishna's service, then this microphone can be considered spiritual. Yeah. So in that sense, I mean, in the sense that it's coming from Krishna and therefore it's divine in that ultimate sense, in the sense of if we dovetail it in Krishna's service, it can be considered divine. So in that sense, the pradhan could be considered divine. The material nature could be considered divine. But actually the pradhan, as it is, you know, that all the ingredients of material nature. You know, of course, when the living entities come in, because they're in maya, they're in material consciousness, so then, you know, most of them misuse it. So when the living entities come in, because they're in maya, they're in material consciousness, so then, you know, most of them misuse it. Yeah. Some of them will take the opportunity to go back to Godhead. Most of them will misuse it. So in that sense, you know, it's like in a strictly material state. But it doesn't mean that it's not, you know, that like the pradhan, before the living entities went into it and started misusing it, doesn't mean that the pradhan is not earth, water, fire, air, and ether. It's definitely earth, water, fire, air, and ether. All those things are there. Yeah. So I think that's really the way to understand the pradhan. Srila Prabhupada ki Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Maya. Okay. Just one point from these, from both verses. It mentions in both verses, or at least in the purports, in both purports it mentions that Mahavishnu is a form of Sankarshan. Actually, I think we may have already mentioned that. But bear it in mind, because I think it's going to come up in the test. Yes, where does Mahavishnu fit into the scheme of things? He's an expansion of Sankarshan. Krishna expands into Lord Balaram, who expands into Sankarshan, who's there in the yantra. Again, my apologies if you don't have a yantra, but he's there. He's there in one of the, on one of the sides, presiding over a certain area of Swetadweep. He expands into Vaikuntha. Sankarshan expands into Vaikuntha, into the second quadruple form or Chaturvyuha. Those four, as they're existing there in Swetadweep, they're called Chaturvyuha. Chaturvyuha. So there is a second Chaturvyuha expanded from Sankarshan in Swetadweep. And they are the four supreme deities in Vaikuntha, that area which is beneath Goloka Vrindavan. So there's another Sankarshan, Vasudev, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. But in this case, the Sankarshan is often referred to as Maha Sankarshan. So we get Krishna, Lord Balaram, Sankarshan, then Maha Sankarshan. Then from that Maha Sankarshan comes Mahavishnu. Yes. So that point, that is mentioned in both of these purports, actually, 7 and 8. So now, as far as our little diagram went, let me just redraw our diagram, because it will be figuring in our discussions today. Would know what is a Shiva Linga. Some of you might not be so familiar with what is a Shiva Linga, but you know, they're very common. You get them around little temples here and there, all over the place. It looks like, well, it's just like, looks something like that. Sort of conical. Something like that. Well, let me just draw it. The Shiva Lingas you see around, they are, did everyone mark themselves present? Maybe some people are not here. Oops, okay, you can just pass it back. Yeah, so like if you go to the Gopeshwar temple, very, very famous temple in Vrindavan, there you'll see, well, if you go in the morning at least, there you'll see a Shiva Linga just like this. And it actually is representing precisely this that we've drawn on the board. Lord Shiva as the male principle in creation, in the total creation. And Maya, but particularly the Adhara potency or the yoni, the womb of material nature, is this part. So that is what Shiva Lingas are all about. Worshipping Lord Shiva in this capacity that we have illustrated here as Shambhu. So next time you see a Shiva Linga, well, we're going on Tuesday to Nandagram. So when we go up to Nandagram, then there's a Shiva Linga up there, and we'll definitely be seeing that Shiva Linga, he's called Nandishvara. Just to the side, near the main temple. So when we go there on Tuesday, if you're not familiar with these things, then you'll be told that this is Shiva Linga, this is Nandishvara Shiva. So you just have a close look, and you'll see sort of basically something like that, and then you can appreciate in terms of our little diagram here. Okay. And right at the end of the purport of text 8, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says that the process of the appearance of Shambhu is recorded in the 10th and 15th shlokas, and we'll certainly read through the 10th now, and actually we hope to go through to the 15th today. So they're explaining, particularly the 15th in fact, is just making a little more clear how Shambhu manifests. So let us carry on then. Let us now read texts. Let's read text 9. Linga yon yatmika jata ima maheshvari praja. All offspring of the consort of the great lord Maheshvara of this mundane world are of the nature of the embodiment of the mundane masculine and feminine generative organs. So we mentioned that the other day, that here we have basically the prototype of all material reproductive processes, the combination of material male and material female. Shambhu, of course, is not entirely material, but due to contact with Maya, we mentioned, then even though he's like a part or a manifestation of or from Mahavishnu, but due to the contact with Maya, he becomes influenced, and the famous example of milk being transformed into yogurt applies. So it is like the original prototype of all material reproductive processes. And that is basically, I don't intend going through the purport of text 9 in detail. Basically, this is the point that he makes. For about the first two-thirds of the purport, that is all he talks about. How the humans, the demigods, the trees and plants and animals, they all embody the male and female principle. And that is how the different species reproduce. He makes an interesting point down in the last one-third or so of the purport, that, or last half even really, he says the feature that is of special significance is that although such expressions as the generative organs of male and female are, how would you pronounce this, indecorous or something like that, means like in bad taste. People don't normally sit around, hopefully at least cultured people, talking about male and female generative organs. But here we have one very high scripture talking about these things. So anyway, he says that, he goes on to say that, yet in scientific literature, these words expressing the above-mentioned principles are exceedingly wholesome and productive of abiding value. In other words, to worship the Shiva Linga, at least particularly in the Krishna conscious context, this is not, I mean, in effect you could argue that you're worshipping generative organs. And from what I understand, when the British came, being good old stiff upper lip type prim and proper people, when they figured out what the Shiva Linga was meant to represent, they thought, oh, just see these Hindus. What are these people worshipping these organs? But actually, when we understand what is the real implications of that, which is illustrated in our little diagram there, that it's a manifestation of Mahavishnu and his mercy on the conditioned souls, and part of the that greater process of the functioning of the material nature, or the cycle of material nature, and like this, then we see that actually it's very it's very important, and it's wholesome and valuable even. Indecorum is merely an entity pertaining to the external custom of science. But science, and especially the highest science, cannot destroy the true entity by deference to social custom. You know, in a sense, it's something like doctors and nurses in hospitals. You know, they see human bodies every day, and often many of them, and the complete body. So in that sense, it's not, you know, like that sort of so-called thrill, which for, you know, very common people, it's like that, the whole sex thing. No, it's just, they're looking from the scientific point of view. And, you know, therefore they're observing the human anatomy from a different perspective. And here, this is the highest science, and we're looking at the highest form of that, and even beyond that, what it represents on the transcendental platform, which is the association of the Lord and his internal potency. So, in that way, not only is it wholesome, but it's actually the topmost wonderful transcendental subject. So that is basically the point there in text 9. Text 10 essentially repeats that, actually. It is basically repeating that and not really adding so much new. There's a little bit, just something we could mention. Let us recite text 10. Shaktiman Purusha Soyam Lingarupi Maheshvara Tasmin Avirabhulinge Mahavishnur Jagatpati. The person embodying the material causal principle, that is, the great lord of this mundane world, Maheshvara or Shambhu, in the form of the male generating organ, is joined to his female consort, the limited energy Maya, as the efficient causal principle. The lord of the world, Mahavishnu, is manifest in him by his subjective portion in the form of his glance, one indifferent. This is some Achintya Bhedabhe Tattva, that the Lord of the world, Mahavishnu, is manifest in Shambhu, in the form of his glance. So it's one and different. Now the point here, the only point that I will mention, I think, is that Shambhu is he embodies the material causal principle. In other words, he has potency to effect change within matter. Whereas Maya is the efficient causal principle. She has the capacity to be changed. It's like that. Shambhu has that potency. You know, again, it can be looked at in from the point of view of the reproductive system. The male injects the living entity into the womb, and the living entity contacts or enters or whatever the egg. And that egg has the facility, or the egg is then changed by that. The male principle, the living entity, without the facility of the egg, the potential body to be, cannot really do anything. And similarly, the egg without the male principle cannot do anything. So they're interdependent, but in their own particular ways. One as having the capacity to cause change, and the other having the capacity to reflect the change, to manifest the form of the change. And Mahavishnu is the ultimate cause. And the other two are dependent on him, but he is not dependent on them. He is independent, and he is the ultimate cause. So those points we wanted to draw out of text 10. And now we're going to go on, and today we're going to try and cover 11, 12, 13, 14 and 15. Generally the purports are much shorter. Starting from verse 11, there is a more detailed description, first of all, of Mahavishnu, and then like further aspects of the process of creation and Mahavishnu's. I mean, it's particularly looking at it all from the perspective of how Mahavishnu is interacting with everything. So let's begin with text 11. If you don't mind, we can read the Sanskrit. Sahasra Shirsha Purusha, Sahasraksha Sahasrapat, Sahasra Bahur Vishvatma, Sahasramsha Sahasrasu. The Lord of the mundane world, Mahavishnu, possesses thousands of heads, eyes, and hands. He is the source of thousands of avatars, in his thousands of subjective portions. He is the creator of thousands of individual souls. You get the message. He's a big man, Mahavishnu. He's very big. Yes. He is very, very big indeed. All the avatars come from him, or really through him, actually. Generally, those avatars are descending from the kingdom of God. Generally, they have their own planets there, but they sometimes appear here, so they come. But seeing he is the presiding deity of the material nature, out of deference to him, they come through him. A few of them reside in him. They don't have Vaikuntha planets. Their eternal position is to be within Mahavishnu, like Hansa, for example, who appears in the, I think it's the 11th canto, isn't it? 11th canto, yeah. Hansa does not have a planet in Vaikuntha. Hansa lives in Mahavishnu. And he's the creator of thousands of individual souls. Of course, we understand that it's not exactly that he's the creator, but he is the rest of all the conditioned souls in between creations. And he's always overseeing them in his different expansions, Garbhadakshay and Sharadakshay Vishnus. So he is, you know, the shelter. He's definitely the shelter of all the conditioned souls. So that was text 11. I think I'll just read the translation of text 12. The same Mahavishnu is spoken of by the name of Narayan in this mundane world. From that eternal person has sprung the vast expanse of water of the spiritual causal ocean. The subjective portion of Sankarshan, who abides in Paravyoma, the above supreme Purusha with thousands of subjective portions, reposes in the state of divine sleep, Yoga Nidra, in the waters of the spiritual causal ocean. So he's known as Narayan sometimes. This name Narayan can be translated to mean, well, one translation is that he is the Ayana, or the rest, of the Nara, of all the living beings. Another way of understanding the word Narayan is he who is lying on the water. This is discussed in the 10th canto, 14th chapter, Lord Brahma's prayers to Krishna, and in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So sometimes he's known as Narayan. Again, he's a part of Sankarshan. And the particular point which the purport focuses on is that generally he is in a state of sleep. Not sometimes when a devotee is sleeping, other devotees may jokingly say that such and such is in Yoga Nidra. We have heard this before. But this sleep here is a different type of sleep. This is divine sleep. When we are sleeping, of course you may argue that I am sleeping for Krishna, so my sleeping is spiritual. But anyway, one way or the other, there is definitely a difference. In the purport, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta gives a little further elaboration. This Yoga Nidra, divine sleep, is spoken of as ecstatic trance, which is of the nature of the bliss of the true subjective personality. The above-mentioned Ramadevi is Yoga Nidra in the form of Yoga Maya. So Yoga Nidra can be understood actually in different ways. Here she's being expressed as being a person. But then we just read how Yoga Nidra means divine sleep. Anyway, there are different ways of understanding this term. But in the context of, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says, divine sleep, which is a state of ecstatic trance in which there is experience for the Lord of the nature of bliss. This particular form of Yoga Nidra, this is very interesting. Mahavishnu, when you see pictures of Mahavishnu, generally you see there's just Mahavishnu, right? Generally. Garbhadakshay Vishnu or Shiradakshay Vishnu, you may see with the goddess of fortune massaging their feet. But generally when you see Mahavishnu, he is in that sleeping state on his own. Am I right? You've seen like that? Yeah. Now, of course, the Lord is never on his own in any of his forms. In all of his forms, an appropriate expansion of his pleasure potency will always be there. Now, in this case, when Mahavishnu is apparently on his own, but he's in this Yoga Nidra, then what is the position or where is Rama? Well, she is inside him. Rama is his pleasure potency. That means that originally, if you want to look at it in that sense, originally Rama, or the pleasure potency, is within the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But in order to increase his pleasure, he places the pleasure potency external. Of course, she's eternally been like that. But in principle, we can look at it like that. in order to increase his pleasure, he has placed his pleasure potency external to himself in a personal form, who is Radharani or Lakshmi Devi or Sita Devi, like this. However, in the case of Mahavishnu, when he's in Yoga Nidra, Rama Devi has been withdrawn within himself. Therefore, you don't see her.